Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Natasha Gonick as my special expert guest. Natasha Gonick has a Bachelor of Science in Biological Science and a minor in Psychology, as well as a complement of other training in occupational health and safety, death investigation, interior design crisis, and suicide intervention. Natasha is a master's level elite athlete and an avid participant in snowboarding, weightlifting, trail running, hiking, climbing, golf, lacrosse, gardening, and woodworking. Since 2013, she has completed over 50 Spartan and other races at an elite level. Natasha has been both a competitive and recreational athlete her entire life. Natasha competed in Fem Sport and was awarded a full CSNA bursary based on her sportsmanship and a keen desire to compete. Her belief is that life is a participant sport in which we get only one chance to enjoy, love, and live. One of the best things we can do is demonstrate to kids and others how to achieve optimum health through fitness and nutrition so they too can fully enjoy the sport of life as they age. Good morning, Natasha, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Thank you, Dr. Holly. That was an absolutely wonderful introduction. You touched on everything that's important to me and that I've focused on in my life, and I really appreciate you allowing me to come and talk, and I hope I'm able to provide some of your listeners with some interesting information, and maybe it sparks some conversations for them around their table and maybe with their kids as they go forward and discuss the issues at hand in our society. So thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And you just kind of nailed it down. That's exactly why I look for people like yourself that are specialized in a certain field. And it all relates to the goals that we have in common to stay well through the various means that we have at our disposal. Now, The thing that captured my interest in you was this aspect of your profession as a death investigator. I know that Tracy loves these forensic shows that, you know, seek to find out who did the dirty deed, and it's all based on evidence and research and DNA and cold cases and all of this. So let's talk about that. We'll talk about other things too, but what do you actually do in your capacity as a death investigator?
First of all, it's not as glamorous as what CSI shows on TV. Sorry, Tracy. The job of a death investigator, at least in the province of Alberta, is we actually do the investigation when there is somebody who is found deceased, whether it's sudden, unexpected, from drug-related or violent deaths or accidental deaths, right to homicides and suicides. In my capacity as a death investigator, I'm ultimately responsible for fielding a lot of calls from doctors. We do deal with a lot of physicians phoning in, asking questions, also reporting deaths. So there's a lot of medical information that comes at us very quickly over the phone. As well, we have call-ins from police, so reporting the death of somebody. And at that point, we often head out, go out to that scene of an investigation where police are already there, they're securing things for us, and we go out and try to piece together some of that puzzle. That's one part that CSI kind of gets right, is it's a puzzle with a lot of pieces. And one component of finding answers for families when somebody's died is to take all those small pieces and bring them together. And hopefully it builds a story of what happened. And it gives the doctors the insight when they're examining the deceased to be able to say, okay, well, this makes sense or this doesn't. So it's a very important part of the process of having an investigator go out, and we take photographs, we evaluate the scene. We're looking at all the details from police and witnesses and families. And part of the challenge often is that we are speaking to these families and witnesses during an absolutely devastating time in their lives. And so there's a lot of training that goes into being able to talk to families when they're in that state, and even being able to get information from people at that. So that kind of sums up what we do. It's a lot of paperwork, you know, as with any medical profession. Everything has to be documented, and these are investigations that go forward and get reported back to families as well as going to court. So it is really important that we do that job, and there aren't very many people that do it. So it is kind of unique. You kind of stumbled on me. I think maybe we were meant to talk at one point and spark the interest of, you know, what other professions are out there and people that exist in the world that have some insights into why people die and the things we can do with our bodies to make ourselves feel better that don't lead to that. I mean, we see a lot of absolutely unfortunate scenarios with how people choose to live, and that's a big piece of what sparks and drives me to live a healthier life.
One thing that comes to mind, Natasha, is are you also a coroner? Is that the same thing as a death investigator, or are they two different things?
They are two different things. Alberta works on a medical examiner system. A coroner kind of handles the same type of thing as far as investigations, but they also determine cause of death. In Alberta, with the forensic pathologist system, we have investigators like myself that would go out. And then there are also the medical doctors, so forensic pathologists that do the examinations and determine cause of death. So it's a little bit of a different system than what exists in where you're at in British Columbia.
Okay, now you show up and there's someone that's apparently dead. Tell us how you determine whether or not they're dead for absolute certainty.
Most of that is done prior to us getting there. A good portion of the examination is done. You know, there are first responders that go out to almost every call. So when the call comes in to 911, it's the standard procedure. Our emergency medical services and paramedics respond out, as well as fire and police. And it's the role of the paramedics, under the guidance of a doctor, often over the phone if they're out at a scene, will determine if somebody is deceased, if there's zero signs of life. And in speaking to that is, if they do feel that there is an opportunity to try to revive that person and resuscitate them, they do take them to the hospital. So it has to be very clear and definitive when they put the ECG on and they're assessing for signs of life. And that's all done well in advance of my arrival on the scene or any of my coworkers. We're often showing up hours after somebody has been found deceased.
Well, just knowing you as I do through our conversations with the CSNA program, and as an athlete, you're like me, you love life, you love to compete, you love to put yourself in motion and feel that intensity and that burn and makes you feel alive. So, you know, you're into life. So what is it about death that interests you? Like you said, it's very unique. I can tell you that my daughter, Ruby, has always been intrigued and interested in working in a morgue on dead people. She's absolutely fascinated by it, but that seems really strange and bizarre to most people. Like, you ask a paramedic, what is it about your job that you like? You're around blood and guts and dead people. You see the worst of it. What is it about people like yourself that are attracted to this kind of profession?
That is a question that I get a lot. And I think it all stemmed when I was in my last year of university. I was actually working on a Medical Research Council of Canada project, cryopreserving cells for transplant. As part of that, there was a tissue bank affiliated, and tissue bank as far as recovery of tissue for transplant, associated with this lab. So as I'm doing my research over the summer, one of the lab techs comes and grabs me and they're like, you know, we have a recovery. Did you want to come and watch? And I thought to myself, I was completely fascinated by the science behind being able to take that tissue from one person and be able to utilize it to save or enhance somebody else's life. And so I went, and again, it blew me away when I was watching this, not only from the side of the science that could occur, but just the immense gift that was from a donor's family in their most horrific time. For them to think of somebody else and what they could do, inside me, it just made me feel that warmth that people actually care about other people. And so through my final year of university, I worked in the transplant program and was eventually hired on to start the first heart valve processing program in Western Canada. And again, dealing with deceased families and all of that was just, it was something that filled, I think, part of a tank in me that made me feel like I was doing something important and that I was contributing to not only their healing process, but to somebody else's ability to have a longer lifespan. So jump forward a little bit here. As life progressed, I had the opportunity to take on a role as a death investigator. And I went back to the same feeling of, you know, here's an opportunity for me to help a family find some answers. And a lot of what we do is dealing with families and talking with them and helping them through that scenario. And for me, I find that very fulfilling.
Now, the first thing that comes to mind again is, does that draw a lot of out of you? Does it really deplete you? Like, do you get personally involved? Have you found a way to empathize and sympathize and connect and show love and compassion, but also not allow it to bring you down to the depths of your own, say, personal hell or whatever?
Well, you know, I have a lot of very good coping skills, and a big part of my coping skills is maintaining my health and exercising, you know, getting out and doing the things that those people are no longer able to do because they're deceased. It makes me appreciate where I'm at in my life and how healthy I am. So for me, I don't tend to get down in the dumps about my cases. I have a few that hit home really hard, and I wouldn't be human if they don't. But I try to have a lot of understanding and compassion for the family members that are left. And it does. That takes a lot of energy to deal with people that are going through grief all the time and to not get drawn in where they're taking too much of my energy. And I think that's the biggest challenge and why I need to replenish with staying in touch with the passions that I do have in life and my family and my friends and my loved ones. And that's how I refill my tank. There's nothing better than having a family at the end of going through the most challenging time thank you for listening to them, even if they were very hard to deal with. So, I mean, that part of it, I try not to give too much of myself, but I do get a lot in return for it. And what I don't get, I try to make up for in doing my other activities.
Very nice. I was standing at a bus stop the other day waiting to catch the bus to go up to the track to do some hammer practice, and a couple of homeless people, because it's right beside the mission, yeah. I was starting to chat to them, and I love talking to anybody, but anybody that will listen, in other words. But these guys, I don't know how we got onto the topic of death, and they were saying there's two things that are inevitable. You know, the standard response is taxes and death. And I said, well, in actual fact, taxes aren't inevitable. They might seem like it, but they haven't always been. But death has always been. And they said, yes, yes, we agree. So knowing that, this is my preamble to the question. If death is inevitable, if we all consciously know that we're all going to die, which is apparently we're the only animal that knows that, as far as we know, why is it that so many people are absolutely shocked, dismayed, blown away, terrified, reduced to a quibbling quiver when someone dies? Because I've seen this myself. It's as if everyone in the room is completely unaware of the fact that people die and that it happens every minute or every second. You probably know the stats. What have you seen in people in terms of their capacity emotionally and intellectually to actually cope with the death of a loved one in their family, be it expected or not?
Actually, the one that surprises me the most is the expected deaths. When I understand it's always a loss. And the grief isn't because always the person's dead. It's regret is a lot of what I hear from people as they're explaining to me what's happening and what they're feeling. And for them, there's all these things in their head. I should have done this. I wish I would have done this. I hear that over and over and over. Oh, our last words were not so nice to each other. Death's inevitable. We're all going to die. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the homeless people, because I always refer to it as, you know, whether you have $1 billion in your bank account or the homeless person, no matter what, you're both going out the same way. You're naked on the table with no money, no personal effects. It's just you and your body. And families actually really have a hard time grasping that concept, that when somebody dies, they're not taking anything with them. What's left behind is left with the people. And I mean that in an emotional state, you know, so these people are emotionally left behind with whatever undone, unfinished or regret that they have or that they had in that relationship with that person. And that's a lot of that I dealt with as a crisis intervention worker, is that, you know, the emotions aren't always because this person's deceased, because they might have been waiting for a month for somebody to die, and it still overwhelms them with grief. They can't believe they're deceased. What did I miss out on? What did I forget to say? And it's all these questions that go through before they can let go and actually be okay with what's happened. That's an interesting question. I like that one.
Well, to me, it's enormously important, because my brother was killed when he was 17 and I was 18, and we were best friends. And so my first response was massive anger. Yeah. I didn't know, I was too young at the time, but it really was an issue of control. I realized I had no control. Then later, I'm not religious at all, but I would study all the religions, and Buddhism teaches a kind of non-attachment to things and people, money, everything. It doesn't mean you're not compassionate, kind, loving, but you're not attached. So what helped me is that I never lost my brother because I never had him. He's not my possession. He's not the thing I had control over. There's much bigger things that are in control of that. And it also put me in the same cylinder of introspection, where my brother was just having fun and got in trouble and did a stupid thing and died for it. And this has been my experience many, many times, but I didn't die. And of course, many of my friends didn't die when we should have too. So I think that you and I both share an interest. What you said is enormously important, the regret. I think that the reason that you summed it up there beautifully, that I can see in people that it's really not about the person that died. It's how they feel inside emotionally about what they didn't say or do. So it's really all about them and not the person, because that person's gone now. What do you think about that?
That's exactly it. You know, it's whatever emotional attachment that that person who's left behind had with that person that died. And, you know, I've been with families as they have held their loved one's hand and sat with them while they died. And the biggest thing that I always ask them to do then is, you know, before they're in a state where they cannot talk to you anymore or realize what's going on, tell them all the things you want to tell them. You know, not in a harsh way, but, you know, there's so much that's left unsaid for people. And in that dying moment, people forget to do that, or they're scared to do that because they're scared to say goodbye before that person is gone. When I was doing the crisis intervention, that's a lot of what I do, is sit with families while they were going through that. And I would always express to them, tell them how you feel. Tell them what your thoughts are. Tell them what your regrets are. Or, you know, how much that last fight really bothered you, you know? And it's healing before they die.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did when I saw my brother's body. I went in there by myself and had a chat with him, and it was good for me. So yeah, I get that. It's interesting to watch people go through this process, to observe it objectively, and to sort of take that as a process of learning and education. Now, with suicide intervention, have you actually sat down or talked to people on the phone who were contemplating suicide? Have you been there?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I've had quite a few times, not just as a work function. So actually, when I first started doing the suicide intervention and finished my course, I was working with the Edmonton Police Service. I had a call come in where it was actually a jumper on our high-level bridge. And in that time frame, while I had him on the phone, I was able to contract him long enough on the phone with me. So contract him, and I mean that, you know, have him contract by the minute that he wasn't going to kill himself. You know, he wasn't going to jump off that bridge until the police got there. And then they were able to take him in, get him to safety, and hopefully get him some of the help that he really did need. In my personal life, I've had friends who have completed suicide. And so I've dealt with that on my own as well, being on the other side, being a friend of someone and family members that have completed. And I've also had coworkers and family members who have been suicidal. And at that point, talking with them. And again, going face to face with and getting them to contract to me that they weren't going to harm themselves. And even, you know, this past Christmas, it's Christmas Eve, and I had a friend on the phone who was suicidal, and it was hour by hour check-ins to make sure that they hadn't harmed themselves. So it's something that, it's a skill set that I know is starting to get talked about a little bit more now that people are being more aware of mental health issues and the role of this old school thought of, oh, don't talk about it, right? If you don't talk about it, it's not happening. If you talk about suicide with kids, they're going to want to go and do it. And that mentality is just so old school. It's something that just needs to go by the wayside. If you talk to somebody who is having thoughts of suicide, you're not going to put a thought in their head to go and do that. To talk to them about how they're feeling, see if they'll share, see if they'll allow you to help them or allow you to aid them in getting to some help or helping them find somebody that they trust to talk about that with. It's a huge thing that I know with some of the celebrity deaths and stuff now has kind of come up in the social media a little bit more, but I mean, it's really a skill set they should almost teach as part of a health class in school. You know, how to talk to somebody who's depressed, how to talk to somebody who's down. You're going to run into it in life no matter what.
So don't we both know that depression is common and that one of the best antidotes for depression, of course, is exercise?
Yes, most definitely. And a lot of the people that I race with and stuff, that's their go-to when they're down. Yeah.
I have a question. If you die, or if I die, who owns my body? Like, I know I'm not a house or a car. Am I property that actually is owned by something, like the state or someone else? Like, the body's laying there. Who owns that body?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I think every province is slightly different with the acts that are in place on how a deceased body is handled. But essentially, in any death that falls under the category of the Fatality Inquiry Act, like we have here in Alberta, or any similar legislation in the provinces, if it is something that's being investigated, so if the death is being investigated, then the province, I guess in this case, so the medical examiner's office, essentially takes temporary possession. And possession's almost a bad word. It's just, we take responsibility for that deceased person to make sure that there's continuity in that investigation. So to make sure that that investigation is done properly and without contamination. And then once we're finished our examination, then the deceased is released back to the family. Now, if it's a non-suspicious death, then that person is, you know, usually sent to the funeral home of the family's choice. The family is who is responsible for handling arrangements for that deceased person.
I see. My sort of understanding in my own head is that I'm not owned by anybody or anything. I'm not anybody's property. I'm a free agent. I'm a product of nature. I'm here on the planet. Nobody owns me. Now, people can put a gun to my head and make me do things that I don't want to do, but you don't actually own me. Right? No. And nobody owns me. Like mom and dad, you don't own me either. Or my wife doesn't own me. Although people think they own their kids. They actually literally own them like property and can buy and sell them like they do historically in some cultures. But see, I'm getting at this huge industry that thrives off of death.
Yes.
And when people die, they're most vulnerable. So I'm going to go to my own personal experience with my brother. My father was challenged by the funeral people and made to think that he was not a loving father because he wouldn't buy the flashy chrome diamond outfitted coffin. And then there's this whole thing about how you are viewed by other people, that if you don't make a big deal about the death and put huge amounts of money into that whole process, that somehow you don't love them. Have you seen evidence of that too?
There are some amazing funeral directors out there that do a very good job being understanding and not pushy and not salesman-like with their clients. and with the families that come in. And I really commend them on not doing the hard sell on people when they're in their worst state. And then there are the ones that just push it over the top. And unfortunately, it sounds like your family was, for lack of better terms, a victim of that type of experience. And yeah, you know, you are reaching these people in their worst time and picking out, you know, if somebody has some regrets outlying, they may try to make it up with a financial, okay, I'll put on a big funeral for them. And so the industry really has a bad reputation because of that. And there's a lot of money made in the funeral home industry. And I think that is one of the big challenges of what people see when they're going through that process. It's not cheap to be able to put a deceased person in the ground or to do a cremation. You know, as part of the funeral homes go, part of taking that stress out of that whole process, now they allow people to go in and kind of set up their planning for whatever they want ahead of time. So they call it pre-arranging. And I think that concept, it's unfortunate it's not advertised as much because it takes that out of that end process. So after somebody's died, if they've already arranged their own funeral ahead of time and what they want, and it's even in most part mostly paid for by the time that somebody does die, you know, it takes that weight off of the family to do it. And I get that, you know, especially with your brother, where it was something unexpected, that's not always possible. But for people who are going through life thinking they're never going to die, well, eventually this is a process that your kids or somebody, they're going to have to make arrangements for you. And so having people look a little bit into their own mortality isn't always such a bad thing. And sometimes can take the burden off of family members who are in an intense process of grieving.
Yeah, this might sound a little crazy, but I've told my wife, Tracy, and all my kids, do not claim me when I die because I'm no longer there.
Yeah.
I'm just a lump of coal. Okay, I'm into this from nothing into nothing, and death and life are the same thing to me. It's what's in between that counts. It's what you do with the life you have, and it's very precious. But when I'm gone, I'm no longer in that thing that you call my body. So to get back at the man, I don't want anyone to claim me. I just want you to watch and see what happens, because they're going to try and convince you to spend money to get rid of me. And I don't want you to do that.
Yeah. Well, they can't just leave you at the table. You know? Yeah, you know, it really is. It's quite the process to think about. And it's good that you've had those conversations, because not enough people do. It's fun because you can actually joke around about it and have quite the conversation of, you know, what you would want done with your body afterwards. And I've even asked, you know, my kids some of those questions, and it's funny to hear their responses as they get older. And, you know, it's sprinkle you on some Spartan course or something.
Yes.
Along that line. But, and every religion views it differently as well. And that's a big component of what goes on and how arrangements are handled and how deceased people are handled too. You know, I mean, I would handle somebody who's Muslim a little bit different than somebody who is not. And you know, like there's religious beliefs that come into play as well. And like yourself, you know, if you have some pretty strong beliefs on that and you've made your family aware, lots of people just never talk about it. And it's not this big blob in the corner that we can't talk about. I mean, death is something that happens. It's part of life. It's part of every aspect of every living cell on earth will die eventually. And so to talk about it and maybe have some lighthearted conversations about it before it comes on your doorstep, I think it's a healthy thing to do.
I agree completely. My son said, Dad, I'm going to fix a Tibetan sky burial for you. And you know what that is? Have you heard of that?
I have heard of that, yeah.
Yeah. You got to pitch me in the field and let the buzzards pick me clean. So, yeah. There's a whole lot of different ideas out there, and I think they're cool. Now, my goodness, our time is almost gone. I just want to touch on this fentanyl fiasco, that, you know, young people dying and what that's all about, because I know what we've talked about this. Can you tell us something about fentanyl? Is it something that people buy on the street and take, or is it something that's hidden in other drugs they use? What have you discovered in your experience?
Well, there's a few things. So fentanyl is obviously used in traditional medicine to treat pain. So it is a prescription drug, but what we're finding is fentanyl and its more toxic partner in crime, the carfentanyl, are making their way in illegal drugs. And these pills are manufactured in condo complexes, in garages, in anywhere somebody can set up their own little pill press and make up a batch. It's relatively easy product to make, although extremely deadly. And the drug dealers are bringing this product in, and there's a lot of money in it. People always ask me, well, they're just killing people that are users. And I'm like, no, they're not. It's more than that. They're not trying to kill them, number one. It's just a cost of doing business. But, you know, they're trying to get people addicted, and fentanyl is very addictive. But a lot of what we're finding is it's mixed into everything. So to find even just like a pure heroin or something pure on the street that hasn't been cut with some form of fentanyl or other analog, I think we're up to like 1,200 or more analogs, which are different types of fentanyl combinations that are really hard to test for. It's being mixed into marijuana. It's being mixed into amphetamines. It's being mixed into any drugs that are being sold on the street. You really have to raise that question of what you're getting. You know, these are designer products that they're manufacturing in a kitchen or a back room someplace. I always like to use the chocolate chip cookie reference. And even my kids get this one. I'm like, you know, what happens when we make a batch of chocolate chip cookies and we're stirring the chocolate chips in? And what happens when you scoop out those cookies? You know, do you have an even number of chocolate chips in there? You never do. You never have the same amount. And I'm like, it's the same as when they're mixing batches of these drugs with a blender. You know, they may scoop out one and it's got very little fentanyl or carfentanil in it, and they take and scoop out the next batch or next amount for their next pill, and it's got 50 times the drug in it. You know, they never know what they're producing. I mean, as you know, BC is the same as Alberta. We're just in this huge opiate crisis right now, and this is why. It's because it is so rampant in the streets, and there's no way to tell. And I think my biggest pet peeve about the whole thing is listening to some of the social media conversations that are out there around this drug. People are saying, well, it's just a bunch of junkies that are dying. And for me, I find that when I deal with somebody deceased, it doesn't matter what their background is, they're a person. And how they got to that place is my puzzle and doctor's puzzle to figure out, but they're still a person. And there's that lack of empathy towards somebody who dies due to their drug dependency or trying it for the first time. These people are often ending up addicted to prescription medications like painkillers, like oxys. And when their prescription, legal prescription, runs out, they're turning to getting illegal drugs on the street to supply that habit. You know, my personal belief is that it's a fall down of the medical community to not have a rehab program for people who have been on some of these heavy-duty painkillers for, you know, a specific injury or disease. And as they come off of it, they need to be brought off properly so that they're not turning to street drugs and then dying from the street drugs. It's a tough subject.
Yeah, it's very controversial, and it brings all kinds of prejudice. It's almost like a kind of a racism where people are really into the war on drugs, and then there's the opposite camp that condemns that approach. And, you know, I've tried to take a shot at that in the CSNA education program, you know, Module 8. It's all about drug so-called addiction and substance abuse. And, you know, now it's about food and sugar, and there's more people addicted to that or so-called addicted. It seems into other drugs that get all the notoriety and attention. But as a final question, because we're out of time, it's nice to talk to someone about these topics that isn't put off by them. You know, and I talk about different topics with people. They just shy away, they run away, they clamp down, they don't want to talk about what I consider to be really important, meaningful things. But what has your experience been like? You've just finished going through the 10 modules of the CSNA and you're writing your dissertation. Can you tell us what that experience was like and what the program did for you?
You know, this is an absolutely amazing program, and I thank Nancy Walkington from FemSport and John and Barbara Bauman, who kind of were a part of that selection process to have me, you know, receive the bursary. Because this is something, I looked at the program, and when I was first reading through it, and I went, wow, this is what I do. This is how I live my life, and this is how I treat vitamins and nutrients. And it was a lot of what I was doing as I was preparing for especially some of my endurance races. And it was a lot of the stuff that I had started to challenge myself to become more educated on. And when I got the program in front of me, you know, having my science degree was extremely helpful, because there is so much of it that is just so strongly, you know, cellular biology based and physiology based. And for me, I love that type of stuff. I kind of get to geek out, as my kids would put it, and really get into the material. And the material that you have in there, Corey, is amazing. You know, it really does allow somebody to be able to approach their nutrition differently, to see, you know, the effects that that's going to have on their body, and to actually help people then the design how that needs to work for them. And for myself personally, I have loved going through this program. And as I finish up my dissertation here, I'm actually almost a little bit sad that I'm done. You know, I'm excited to go and work more with people and actually have my certification behind me to say, yeah, you know what, look, I've gone through all of this training and I've went through this amazing program that's offered, and it has given me a very, very strong skill base and knowledge base to draw from to help people. And thank you for putting together that. It's remarkable. I would recommend it to anybody who's looking to do any type of personal trainer or any type of nutrition programming. You know, it's different from other stuff that's out there, and it's fantastic.
Well, thank you very much. That's very much appreciated. I love that response, because that helps me stay motivated, and it provides more of a meaningful relationship that I have to you as a student and to other people. Our time is gone. What a fantastic interview, fantastic insight from you, and I want to speak to you again another time. We'll finish off with a final word. Perhaps you could leave us with something more philosophical that relates to this issue of death, about living life in your terms.
Yeah, you know, I would like to encourage people. I think the biggest thing that I see is challenge people to go back to the basics of being with the people around them. You know, go back and have a positive impact on the people's lives, your family, your friends, other people. When you're dealing with somebody, no matter who they are, if there's someone in a grocery store, a homeless person on the corner, or your best, treat them with compassion, treat them with understanding, and choose to acknowledge that they might have struggles that you're not seeing, and encourage people to just be open and share. I mean, it's something we don't do with each other than from behind a computer. So I'd love to see people getting out more often, challenging themselves to participate in life. Get out there, do it. You really do only get to utilize your body once in life. Take the chance, go with your family, go do things you love to do, find some passions, and you will actually feel more alive as a person, and more understanding, more compassionate, and just appreciate what's around you.
Natasha Gonick has been my expert special guest on this edition of SNU. She is a professional in the field of occupational health and safety. She's a death investigator, and she's also a master's level elite athlete, and is a wonderful inspiration to everyone around her to live life and to enjoy it to the fullest. Natasha, we thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Holly. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you today.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Holly Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHolly.com.
Represent your lifestyle. new way of life. Listen. It's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight. Malik with sports nutrition update. Prolong your life, live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHolly.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see ya changing heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.